Well, this is a public lecture given in Auckland on the 4th of June 1974 by Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson. The title, The Birth of Universes, Their Formation and Development According to the Divine Idea. This is the second of a series of talks given by Mr. Hodgson.
Friends, our three subjects, first three subjects, are in reality as one continuous study for students of the ageless wisdom. We began, therefore, last time with a study of the ideas of the Supreme Deity in universe and in man. This evening we carry our subject further and will consider the manifestation of that Supreme Deity in relationship to a universe as a creator, or better, as an emanator, preserver and transformer of all that exists. Then next time we will move forward to study the hierarchies of the creative intelligences, archangels and angels, their nature and their functions in the production of the invisible and visible universes. Tonight, then, we ask ourselves, how did the universe begin? What is the origin of its existence and so of our own here in the midst thereof? Well, there are said to be three possible explanations of the origins of life, particularly life here on our earth. First, that it all was supernaturally created. Second, that it was brought from some other part of the universe. And third, that it arises by natural processes from inorganic matter. Those are the general views of the scientist. But you find them rejecting the first two, particularly that of supernatural creation. Not because they think they are false, but because they are not, strictly speaking, explanations at all. It is in the nature of science, as of course you know, that it attempts to define all that we observe in terms of natural laws. And so, to bring in the supernatural assumptions would be to break, might I say, the rules of the game. This, I gather, is not, of course, meant to imply that no supernatural sphere exists. But if we habitually brought in such assumptions whenever something appeared difficult to explain naturally, then there would be no science at all. And so there are at present three basic theories. And while it is possible, in principle at least, to test these theories by observations of distant galaxies, by radio and optical telescopes, the measurements have by no means reached the stage where any one of those three can be rejected, despite claims made to the contrary. What are they then, these three suggestions? One of them is called the expanding universe. All who believe in this accept the well-established fact that the whole universe is at present expanding. This has been scientifically proven and was discovered by Professor Hubble in 1929. The whole universe is steadily expanding. Then the second, it's called, I notice, the steady state theory. It assumes that as the universe looks the same in all directions in space, it must therefore always have looked the same in time. Therefore, there is no beginning and there is no end. The procedure ever continues. But to compensate for the continuous vacuum caused by the perpetual expansion, it is found necessary to postulate that new matter is continually being created. That's the second theory. First, the expanding universe, then, as they call it, the steady state theory, and third, this is called the oscillating universe, and it's of two parts. One of these assumes that the expansion commenced from a super dense state and will go on expanding indefinitely. One view, not generally accepted, especially just now, I noticed. And the other idea is that the expansion will eventually turn to contraction, and that the super dense state will again be reached. And then the whole cycle will begin again. This is referred to as the oscillating universe. For the whole cosmos, everything is thus regarded as performing a giant swing, a tremendous cosmic oscillation. And it's further postulated that after thousands of millions of years, expansion will cease and the worlds will collapse into the former focus, the primeval atom, where material individuality will vanish and disappear, only to rebound and precipitate itself into a new expansion, creating new worlds. That's the oscillating theory. Attempts have been made to measure the time periods for these oscillations. The time, for example, for a complete cycle has been postulated as, and be prepared for a tremendous number, 30,000 million years. And during this interval of time, which could be called the cosmic year, galaxies and stars and the Milky Way and the planets, of course, are formed. Suns, S-U-N-S, are born, become extinct, then explode. Life develops on the surface of planets and perishes. So one scientist affirms. Most scientists now agree that the universe began with a cataclysmic explosion of an extremely dense primordial atom, and that the billions of star-filled galaxies, including our Milky Way, are still rushing outwards from the original, now comes a familiar phrase, I suppose, the original Big Bang. And this is known as the Big Bang Theory. The speed of the expansion has been determined by astronomers, and they say it's now decreasing. I noticed the very latest statements being slowed down by the gravitational pull of the galaxies one upon the other. Such then are the three theories. The expanding universe, the steady state theory, no beginning and no end, and the third, the oscillating universe, which is referred to humorously as the Big Bang Theory. So much then, friends. I felt I had to spend a little of our time together looking at the scientific views. So much for the present advance of knowledge. And so, let us do what we're gathered here to do. Turn to the views of the spiritual scientists, the range of whose powers of research extend far beyond that of the physical scientist, and, yes, and towards the very source of the existence of the universe. Theosophy, thus studied, is found to be a scientific, a spiritual, a scientific, and intensely practical philosophy of life. It's based on the discoveries of seers and sages, philosophers and scientists whose findings have been checked and counter-checked throughout innumerable ages, right down to the present, and continuing on into the future. Such is theosophy thus viewed. Now then, guided then by such teachings, but of course, yes, I must say this, not expressing an orthodoxy, for opinion is free amongst us, nevertheless, we now will turn our thoughts to the emanation and the formation of universes as the occult scientists reveal. And so our thoughts will go back to that pre-cosmic condition in which it is said in the book of Genesis, you remember, darkness was upon the face of the deep. Then you remember when the cosmic hour had struck, so to say, divine or spiritual energy was liberated, and there was thus initiated the whole cosmic process of the emanation, formation, and perfecting in orderly progression of the universes and all that they contain and will ever contain. In Genesis, the actual words are, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Then it happened. Then the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." Great key there. The voice, sound, speech, expressive of creative ideation. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day. And darkness he called light. And the evening and the morning were the first day. Now let me, as a theosophist, suggest only an interpretation. First, then, there was duality in unity. The Word, which was God. Masculine, creative spirit. And on the other hand, the face of the deep. The feminine, creative principle, matter. Space, if you like. So, positive and negative existed. The eternal poles, the dual principles, spirit, matter. But before that, during the long night, should I say, upon the vast ocean of space, called in some philosophies, by the by, the great abyss, the great deep, upon the vast ocean of space, there was darkness which brooded upon the face of the deep. All slept. The whole of boundless space was dark and quiescent to any finite intelligence. The Sanskrit scholars give a name to this period, which is, expect you know, but I'm linking up, pralaya, meaning rest. P-R-A. L-A-Y-A, rest. All slept. The whole of boundless space was dark and quiescent. Then, as I've said, a change occurred. The Spirit of God emerged from absolute existence, and in these biblical terms, is said to have moved upon the face of the waters. Or to put it otherwise, as in other cosmologies, the great breath breathed upon the great deep. Or, biblically, God spake, saying, "Let there be light," and there was light. Otherwise expressed, at the beginning of creative day, these two, universal spirit and universal matter, produce a third. They combine to produce a third, a sun, which becomes the presiding deity, Logos, or Word, the architect of the universe to be. So now a change has occurred, you see. A finite principle has thus emerged from the infinite. Universal spirit matter motion has become focused into a being which is beyond normal human comprehension. Let us study it for a time together. This, the formative Logos, is taught as being the first objective emanation from the Absolute. It's the principle of divine thought, to be made manifest in an individual sense. Firstly, in there'll be three grades of that, I should have said, of that manifestation. First, as the logos of the whole cosmos and all that it contains. We studied that the other day. The deity of the indwelling deific principle of all that exists. The spirit essence of the whole cosmos. Then, the logos of one solar system. If we may say so, our solar deity, worshipped in many religions as our Lord the Sun. And then, as we saw last time, thirdly, the spiritual self of every human being. And these three, the sages continually insist or teach, are one. Indivisible, identical, an integral part of each other, a whole. A theory to us, of course, tremendous one, that the great emanating Lord of all that exists, and the great directive intelligence and power and wisdom of our universe, and that same principle of divinity in each one of us, the same. And here we come into the realm of religion, to which I can't enter tonight, except to say that there is a means whereby such a tremendous concept can increasingly begin to be real. And I expect you all know what it is. The regular practice of contemplation of the divine. And he or she who daily is able to grant themselves time thus to withdraw in thought from this ever-changing world into that, into the presence of that unchanging and eternal principle, they will begin to experience, as it were, the awakening of a fire, the dawning of a light, or the birth of an understanding that such a triplicity could indeed be one. And the divine in us, that one. And this is the objective, really, of all yoga. Now, let us progress from these three fundamentals, the logos of cosmos, solar system, and in man. We now turn to the activity of the first creative logos or deity, the architect and fashioner of forms. And in this, St. John helps us in words which doubtless are quite familiar to you all. Here they are, I brought them along. Chapter 1, verses 1 to 5. In also dealing with creation and with the manifestation in man. Marvelously, listen, friends. In the beginning was the Word, capital W, logos, verbum, as you will. In the beginning was the Word. I'll define it a little more in a few moments. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. There we have the Logos doctrine, the famous Logos doctrine. The deity as universal ideation, as thought, as manifesting that ideation by means of the power of formative sound. A tremendously potent power, physically and superphysically and spiritually, the power of sound. Whether spoken by a human being, every sound, every word produces its appropriate effect in the atmosphere and in the auras and consciousness of hearers, and carried right upwards and inwards, this same mighty power of speech, if you like, thought imbued sound, if you wish, this whole universe was brought into being. The manifested deity who speaks the creative word, whereby universes spring into being and into life, is generally known by the Greek word, the Logos. Logos means a combination of thought and sound. So it is taught then, the creative word expressive of the divine idea is spoken. And the whole universe is thus conceived as in divine thought, as an idea, which is held there throughout eternity. And this idea, it is taught, is the governing power in creation. Then when the creative word is spoken, meaning, of course, not any word as we know it, but an inconceivably powerful and magical sound, the creative word expressive of the idea is spoken, then the seeds of living things germinate and appear from within the ocean of space, the great deep. Movement has begun. The germs have been fructified and forms have appeared. Did I repeat that Egyptian cosmogonical explanation of this the other day? If so, excuse repetition. There it is taught that the supreme deity, Amen-Ra, that's the solar logos, hovered, of course this is dimensionally an error, but has to be put this way, hovered above the waters of space. Emptiness existed. And then he spoke the creative word. What did he say? Well, he stood, he hovered there before the great deep, an Egyptian view. The Theban Trinity, by the by, and said, called out, come unto me, and the germs of all things, the seeds of all things, became germinated, and the universe appeared. At first then, the idea conceived by the supreme artist exists only as universal thought. Then the divine hour strikes. Symbolically, the Logos begins to utter his word. That which in the beginning was only his thought is now named. I can't expand that, it's so magical. Is now named, and the name is uttered. Metaphorically, the divine idea expresses itself creatively as sound. I presume it's just like the great creative musicians, in whom, in their higher consciousness, I assume, the idea of the whole composition dawns, and then comes the task of its manifestation as sound, mentally, according to musical and mathematical laws, and emotionally, to be filled with the highest feelings, and then eventually, through all the instruments, a single one, the human voice, or the whole great orchestra, like the orchestra of space, sounds forth. And that sound is expressive of the idea which was in the mind of the composer at the beginning. I hope I'm not bringing the concept down, but that, I presume, is somewhat descriptive of that which occurs. Similarly, when the one great composer of all, when the hour strikes and pralaya, rest, gives place to manvantara, activity, then he or that, for of course there's no sex in this, that utters its word, or, and the great composition of nature as a whole, in all its possibilities, from dawn right to eve, and all that can ever appear in any kingdom of nature, all conceived in divine thought, gradually in consequence, in response to the play of the sound upon space, begin to appear. The Logos doctrine, friends. Metaphorically, I repeat, the divine idea expresses itself creatively as sound, and that uttered sound, playing upon the matter of virginal space, causes it to assume the conceived forms, filled with the one life. The body, or the sound of the divine idea, then appears in matter of increasing degrees of density, until at last here we are at the physical level, in the kingdoms of nature, right down to the mineral, eventually are brought into existence. But behind every atom and every form of every kind, there is a divine music, a chord, call it what you will, so that these, for example, are all singing, could we but hear it. And there are those who've caught echoes of it, petal by petal, leaf by leaf, stem by stem, and seed and root by root, all expressive of, and as it were, singing the great song of creation. Emitted, shall we say, by the great, I nearly said, gardener and husbandman of man of all. Yes, I dare. Yes, I dare. God is a great husbandman, if you will. Not only in the fields of physical matter, substances and plants, but in every field of nature, gathering the harvest, which consists of the gradually evolving spiritual selves of human beings, animals, human beings, angels and archangels, rising ever to greater and greater heights, which means nearer and nearer to that of which they are a manifestation. This is the divine harvest. I presume, of the great logoic husbandman. I mustn't let my mind go on, or I shall start talking about the solar systemic harvest festival. Oh, yes, there are such things, you see, because life evolves in waves with its crests and its deeps, and there must therefore be times when this great evolving, expressive procedure, just as in music and in all creation, reaches its height and its greatness of sound, beauty, and form, and is followed then by a natural regression, from which and the next wave arises. And at the crest of each wave, surely, a great harvesting must occur. And so it is said that creation is but the thinking out of a thought in the mind of the Logos. Nice. One thinks of the artist at once, of course. Or the architect. One of the great titles of that Lord is the great architect of the universe. And it is also said, the singing of the song of the Lord ever continues. And the song or music or symphony of creation is perpetually composed, expanded, and performed. And that brings us to what I was saying. Some philosophies regard the Logos as the divine yogi, producing all by concentrated thought, whose concentration never wavers for one moment, whoever holds in his highest thought the one divine idea. And this he expresses, it is taught, in sound, in uttermost perfection, and without even the possibility in a break, of a break, in the concentrated performance of the great symphony of creation. And that is why he and his assistants are sometimes called Dhyan Chohans, meaning lords of contemplation. And he, in some religions, that, should I say, is worshipped as the Lord Shiva, the divine yogi. And I've heard them say, if for one moment the concentration of the divine yogi failed or halted, all would disappear. Never for one moment does that occur. By the by, this is all wonderfully worked out by Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland, in a marvelous allegory in which pretty well all I've been saying is stated in the form of a kind of allegory in which Tweedledum and Tweedledee and Alice are walking through the woods. Do you remember? Do read it if you haven't. They hear a terrible noise. And Alice said, what is that noise? That was all dark, and she heard this noise. And Tweedledum say, oh, it's only the Red King snoring. Let's go and see him. So away they go, and there he is, deep asleep and snoring. And they're talking. What a wonderful sight he is, said Wonderful. Shh, said Alice. You'll wake him, if you talk so loud as that. Wake him, said he. Do you think you could wake him when you're only a thing in his dreams? You don't think you're real, do you? And she said, well, if I'm not real, she's only a little girl, then what are you? And he said, ditto. Then she felt so sorry she began to cry. And Tweedledee says, no use your crying. You don't think those are real tears, do you? And he said, supposing that their king was to wake up and stop sleeping and snoring, do you know what would happen to you? Well, you'd disappear altogether, for you're only a thing in his dreams. Oh, friends, it's most wonderful. It's as near as can be to what one who attempts to teach this sublime philosophy can go, but in another form, of course. Thus, he, the one alone, the divine yogi, is said to dwell in concentrated thought upon the ideal, the archetypal forms. He chants the sounds of their name from one eternity to another. Yes, and it is said that by his ever-uttered word, he brings universes into existence, sustains them, and perfects them as they evolve. The one supreme Logos, Word, Lord of all. I have a few moments, I see, though that's the end of my contribution. Perhaps I might share some thoughts that have been going through my mind concerning this concept that the whole of existence and this universe of ours and this world on which we live is brought into being for the fulfillment of a divine procedure, which is the continual evolution to higher and higher states of the progeny of the Lord, his children, his sons, ourselves. And I found myself saying to myself something like this: when once an individual really discovers that the purpose of existence is evolution to a higher state, then the intelligent individual collaborates. I'm coming to believe, my friends, that in that collaboration lies the whole secret of health and happiness. Not altogether new, the idea of assent to the divine purpose has been presented, oh yes, throughout the ages. And this assent or consent, it is taught, is not the fruit of strained effort. It's a quiet yielding of one's entire being to the great plan and the great planner. And someone has said that the problem behind all problems is that of teaching man to consent to the cause and the constitution, yes, and the purpose for the existence of the universe. Thy will be done. And so, an author, Newton Dilloway, in his book, Consent, puts it like this: take the principle of consent, apply it at once, and it will fill you with new life. The principle of consent, fully applied, establishes or restores the rhythm of health in the body, the rhythm of insight in the mind, and it opens ever to wider and higher peaks of realization and achievement. Yes, but of course it means total assent and letting person and individuality have no place at all. Not easy, is it? Not easy. I believe it's the great way to happiness. Newton Dillaway says, in proportion about himself, in proportion of my capacity to consent, to let go, to get myself out of the way, I am used. That's wonderful, you see. For theosophists, some of us, we've accepted and we are filled with that idea of being used. Or just put in other words, channelship. For that one divine life. And if this truth, he goes on, this flow comes to our minds, we suddenly expand to its dimensions, as if we grew to worlds. And this insight throws us on the party and the interests of the universe. Yes, against or contrary to all and sundry, and particularly ourselves. The self is not used. It's in the way. But as it is dropped, as it were, in this particular, common sense must be observed, then the divine life, apparently, may flow through. But, he says, this comes only to that mind which consents to be used. It's almost like a religious philosophy, isn't it? We have to look after ourselves of our dependence and fulfill our duties and meet our obligations more fully than ever. But in our hearts, we're not grasping anything for our own possession. Only to be ever more and more, I suppose, I'm dreaming, to be ever more and more an open, consenting channel to the fulfillment of the divine idea, which is, of course, the evolution to the higher states of all that exists. Thus, I suggest to you this very profound cosmogonical teaching of theosophy may perhaps be applied to you and to me and all of us in the living out of our lives amongst each other and in the world. Thank you.